Hi, I'm Carmen Capozzi. I have an organization called Sage's Army. We're a nonprofit grassroots organization to create awareness for the drug problem. We have people dying in record numbers from drugs, from prescription pills, heroin. It's littered our streets. We're in my headquarters. It's the Sage's Army headquarters. It's called Sage Haven. This is our place that we come together and create what we're going to do in the community. We're trying to bring community involvement and just be a prominent force in the community to let people know there's a problem and, you know, to educate the community. We have people that want to get involved that have lost kids, that we have people in recovery that get involved after, you know, they got so much time clean, they want to get involved and help somebody else, guide somebody else in the path of recovery. You know, we have to help. We help parents. We understand, you know. We try to meet the person where they're at. You know, if they have a child that's dealing with a substance problem, we investigate and we try to guide them in the right direction. You know, sometimes it's for the parent. Sometimes, you know, a lot of times, unless their child wants help, we're helpless to do anything. So we try to help the parent. We offer, you know, we have a list of meetings for parents, Narnon meetings, Al-Anon meetings. We try to get them educated. You know, as parents, every parent spoils their child. And that carries through with drug addiction. I mean, we become enablers. We don't want our kids to fail, so we try to pick them up. You know, we don't want our children to lose their jobs. We don't want them to be stigmatized. You know, I know for me, you know, I didn't want to 302 my son. That was my last resort, was to 302 him, and I didn't want to do that because he liked to hunt. And if I 302'd him, he wouldn't be able to go hunting because you can't have a weapon. And I'm like, okay, what do we do? You know,
what is 302?
A 302 is when you can commit your child or, you know, someone that you love in your family when they're a danger to themselves. And that's a fine line. You know, it's, I had to lie. I mean, my son wasn't suicidal, but he was going to kill himself on drugs. You know, you sit and second guess every move you make. It's like, okay, should I do this? Shouldn't I do this? You know, the professionals say, kick them out. And I wouldn't. And then, you know, I gave Sage an ultimatum. I said, look, you either can stay here and work a program or you have to go. And he chose to leave. And that was a Wednesday, and by Sunday he was gone. That's when we got the call. He kept calling. You know, he was coming home. We were going to talk. Everything was fine. You know, we talked 3 times a day. Me and Sage were very close. But, you know, what happened was we lost my mom to cancer 8 days before Sage died. And, you know, going through my grief of losing my mom, trying to help my dad get through it. And I kind of took my eyes off of Sage and didn't pay attention to his grief. Him and my mom were very close. And he decided, well, one more time. You know, I'm gonna drown out this sorrow with one more time. And that's what killed him. The first time I realized Sage had a problem was at 17. He asked to take a day off of work. It was a beautiful summer morning. It was his 11th grade year. And I didn't need him. He was going golfing with a couple of his buddies. One of his buddies was a football player in his high school, and he, I said, "Yeah, go have fun. You know, I don't need you, and go spend a day golfing." And I get a call later that day that from the police that he was in the police station, and I needed to get there. And I got there, and they had the boys separated, and Sage was in shackles and handcuffs. And I was like, "What is going? What did you do?" And he wouldn't tell me. He was scared. And eventually he wouldn't tell me until court placed him. We had to go to court. He got him put into a program called Outside In, all boys program, excellent program. And there they teach you the truth will set you free. So he said, "Dad, I'm sorry, I'm doing pills and heroin." And I said, "Sage, what are you talking about? Where? When?" And he said that his friend, the football player, broke his leg, got prescribed OxyContin. And, he liked him that much, he turned on his buddies. But he goes, "But, Dad, that wasn't the first time." And I said, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "At 14, a guy approached one of his friends on his baseball team that I helped coach. A guy approached him and said, 'Here's a stamp bag of heroin. Snort it. You won't become addicted. You know, you'll love it.'" And they took it and sat, and they weren't going to do it. And at the last minute, they just decided, let's just see what it does. And they snorted it. And Sage said he threw up and he hated it, didn't like it. But then the pills, Adderall, I think it was 12 or 13, they diagnosed Sage ADHD, which I didn't see it. You know, Sage golfed, he played guitar, he wrote songs. He was very focused in that, but he didn't like math and English. And they said he didn't pay attention. So, we put him on Adderall, and I didn't like what it did. I didn't like what it turned my son into, and I took him off it, and we put him on something else. But that opened up the door to, "Hey, man, what do you take? I take Adderall. What do you take at school with the other kids?" And they, I guess they started, pill parties, or what do you call them? They call them farm parties, where they put pills in a bowl. They steal them from home, and they put them in a bowl. That's the first time. I thought as a parent, I'm going to have to deal with pot and alcohol. That's what I thought. Keep your eyes open, Carm. You're gonna, this is what we're gonna see. That was what we seen in my day. That's what we're gonna see. Yeah, we seen much worse. It blew my mind.
What happens when somebody walks through that door?
It all depends where they're at. We have people that walk through the door that just want support. When they walk through that door, we find out their needs and we make the calls. There's people that I had a young man here. He was in the Navy, and he was actually on the ship that dumped Bin Laden's body in the water. And, he suffered the, what's it called?
PTSD.
PTSD. And he, he didn't know what to do. And he was struggling hard. And I just sat at this table with him, and I said, "Call this number. Dead end. Call this number. Dead end. Call this number." Little bit of light, all right. Let's remember that one, all right. There's no beds available. We called the VA, set up an appointment, got him in the VA. I gave him a hug and told him I loved him. And he left. He's He's over 90 days clean. Got him into the VA, worked with him, got him into a place, and now he's down in Florida in a great recovery house. He's doing awesome. And that was how I met that boy was through a chance meeting with his mom 50 miles away. And this lady recognized me. And she said, when she found out my name, she goes, "Are you Sage's dad?" And I went, "Do you know Sage?" And she goes, "No, but I come to your page every day for support. My son's an addict." And I went, and she helps Sage's Army now. That's how it's worked.
So it's different for everyone that comes through?
Everyone. We have mothers. We have fathers. We have fathers that are just helpless. They don't know what to do. If we don't, put it this way, it's unlimited. If we can't help them immediately, I have enough people to network to find a solution. You know, that's one of the things with Sage's Army. We have been able to inspire people to seek help because people are afraid. Like, I just dealt with a young man that, it's the shame and guilt. And when I finally was able to get him to an NA meeting, and when he got there, he knew three people and was able to exchange numbers for rides. And he called me the next day and goes, "Carm, I think I'm ready. I want to go to rehab." And his girlfriend just did CPR on him down in the hood. He overdosed, and he was dead. And the ambulance got there and hit him with Narcan, and she freaked out, and she ended up going to treatment. But what happened was, he out of his mouth, he says, "Is this like a mental institution? Am I going to be locked in a room and stuff?" I said, "No, but they don't understand, we're able to make them feel comfortable and guide them, the support, a lot of these kids don't want to talk to their parents. I had a girl that came, she wrote me a letter through Facebook and told me her issues, and, she was afraid to tell her parents. She was shooting OxyContin. And a young man showed her and her friend how to melt it down and shoot it. And we got her. She basically every day would come to our house, me and my wife, and she would sit in the office. At the time, Sage's Army was my mother-in-law's basement. But she would sit in the office with Cindy and just do Sage's Army paperwork and I take her to a movie. I take her to a meeting. Now she has a beautiful young girl, little girl, and it's amazing. We do speaking engagements. We go to schools. We go to churches. We do community events. Anything where there's people, we try to get involved and set up a table. It's pretty amazing when you're in a town and they're doing an ethnics fair, or home show. And you got 4,000 or 5,000 people walking through and they stop at your table and you get another story. Or you pull somebody else in. What this has done is showed people, look, you don't have to be ashamed to talk about this. You don't, the enemy wants us to hide in stigma. They want us to stay in the dark. Sage's Army is trying to bring people out of the dark and show them, look, you don't have to stay in the shadows. You did nothing wrong. A parent, they feel less of a parent. They feel, this is my fault. What I tell parents is, tell them you love them. Tell them you're here for them when they want help. Tell them that they're not in trouble, that if they want help, we'll get them help, but that's all I can do. That's all that you can do. You can't make them go to meetings. You can't make them go to rehab. They got to want to go. That's the scary thing about this. You know how Sage's Army started. I'll tell you how we started. Sage died March 5th, 2012. They took me to my parents' house. And like I said, we just lost my mom. And I spent 2 days on the floor. On the second day, I heard Sage's voice say, "Dad, get up. They're not bad kids. You have to help." And I sat on the bed, and I just sat there and thought, I got to do something. I don't know what. And I left. And it was 8 days after that, March 15th, 2012, a young boy showed up at my house with a laptop, and it was the Sage Kaposi Memorial page on Facebook. And he showed me what people were saying. About 180 of his friends were on it. And there was this beautiful letter from the president of his college. And I read this letter, and I'm like, how did he know Sage? Because he nailed him. He talked about, his anti-drug songs, his music that he wrote, wrestling, baseball, golf. Sage hit a hole-in-one. He talked about his hole-in-one. I'm like, how did he know that? What was the guidance counselor at the college? She was trying to help us get Sage his credits and get him into the Marines. She still talks to my wife on a regular basis. I'm sitting there reading that letter, and I just stared at my couch. And it was like a split-second thought, but I thought of two people. Guidance counselor at his high school. The man had no compassion for what we were going through. He was one of those guys that pointed the finger. Parents need to be parents. You know, we've gone to him, and he would look at us. And then, we were part of the problem. I didn't understand the problem. You know, and today I look at it, he probably didn't understand the problem either. So we were both very naive to this. So the other person I thought of was the local cop when I 302'd Sage. I had to wait 3 hours. I had to go get papers signed by a judge, go to my local police force, and I had to wait 3 hours for him to get there. We get there. He's still not there. There's a little phone there. You call. He said, "I'm busy. I'll be there in 45 minutes. We go. He comes in. We're standing at a counter. He comes in, takes off his hat, slides over his garbage can, and goes, "What's the problem?" We start talking. And at the time, it didn't bother me, but he kept spitting his chew in the garbage can. And at the time, I was so focused on getting Sage help. But that moment, sitting on my couch, I realized that guy had no compassion for what we were going through. He said, he said some things to us as parents, and he said to me, he goes, "Okay, is this boy going to try to fight me?" And I said, no, he's not going to try to fight you. He's probably going to shake your hand and thank you. And we left. And after about an hour, he called and said he got Sage. And he goes, "You were right." I said, "About what?" He goes, "He shook my hand and thanked me." And I said, "Yeah, right, because he hates it." And so sitting on my couch that day, I knew I had to do something. And I looked at Nick, the young man sitting next to me with the laptop, and I said, "Nick," I said, "Sage's heart was good. He was always trying to help his friends. I need to create awareness. I need an army of people." And he went, "Oh, cool, dude, Sage's Army." And I went, "What?" He goes, "Hold on a minute." 10 minutes later, he created a Facebook page called Sage's Army. And he tagged some of his friends to it. He goes, "Check it tomorrow." So I did. Well, I got up the next morning and had to check on my guys. I haven't been to work in 10 days. And I went and checked on my guys. And I came home that night and went to the Facebook page. And there was 1,800 people signed up in 24 hours asking for help or telling me their situation or sending me their pages. So many people want to judge, and I say, I don't I don't ask people how they got addicted, how this happened. I say, do you want help? It's not, you know, it's important that we know where it starts, but when they're coming to me for help, we don't go there. We just want the solution. How are we going to get you? How are we going to inspire you to get help and stay in help? Because the thing is, we can get people in recovery. It's keeping them there. You know, it's you know, insurances, you know, you're lucky if you get 7-14 days. Good insurance, you know, you'll stay longer. But then, you know, the transitioning, you know, we got people from rehab to a detox to the rehab, and now we got to get them somewhere, if it's home or to a three-quarter house. You know, you don't see a lot of halfway houses anymore because there's no money. So they go straight to a three-quarter house where, you know, me or you can open up a three-quarter house. And then you got to get them to stay. Then you got to, you know, you got drug dealers in the neighborhood, you know, and you got to, they got to walk this line. They got to walk with blinders on. And you got to teach them to be able to walk without the blinders on and not go to the drug. But you can't do that in such a small little short time without the proper people, you know, because, you know, one of the things that Sage's Army has done is we've pushed people into action. Yeah, it's been a struggle. It's been 3.5, you know, almost 4 years, and it's been a struggle to get people to understand. You know, there's county funding. Well, a lot of times you can't find a bed county. So what I've done is I've went and researched facilities and went and toured these places. And if I don't like them, I don't use them. And they know that. And if I have a problem, I call them and say, look, you know, there's a problem here. I got an individual in there, and this is going on, and this is going on. And, you know, they want, you know, I mean, it's big business, you know. And the thing is, nonprofit, they struggle, you know. So some people say, well, you know, for-profit is a bad thing. No, not if they're helping people. You know, hospitals make money. We got to get people help.